Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Horse Sense, a show for the thinking horse person. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and sometimes even inspirational information to enrich your horse's life. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners can't. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week I'm talking to Shannon Lee of Advanced Equine Dentistry. Shannon is an equine dental vet and is one of the leading dental vets in Australia. He's a bit of an international expert, trotting around the globe, talking on this subject. And in this interview, I talked to him about why dental care is so important and also clear up a lot of the common misconceptions I hear about this topic. This interview is just full of really great information. So listen up. So welcome to Horse Sense, Shannon, and thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no worries, Amanda. You know, good to have an opportunity to sit down and chat.
Excellent. So let's just go ahead and get into it. What do you do and why do you do it?
To keep it simple, what I do is dental procedures or anything involving the teeth and sinuses in horses and related animals, so ponies, donkeys, the odd wacky one that's not really a horse at all. And that's the gist of what I do. There's a fair bit of other stuff involved, but that's the gist.
I know that you're a qualified vet, and so what made you choose equine dentistry over just general veterinary or equine veterinary science?
So I'm a dental veterinarian, which means I spent my 5 years doing my undergrad veterinary degree. I then went on and did further training. I then went on and sat by examination with the Australian and New Zealand College of Veterinary Scientists Equine Dentistry. The college is the postgraduate body, much like in most parts of the world, there is a body for human surgeons. That's our postgraduate body with their various branches, is the Australian New Zealand College of Veterinary Scientists. So I sat examinations with them. That achieves membership level, and that's not a registered specialist, but that's a postgraduate level of qualification. And then I continued on with further study, and then I completed a diplomat qualification in equine dentistry. So all of my qualifications are recognised postgraduate veterinary dental qualifications. Very important difference for people to understand. It's no different from when they go to see an orthodontist or a periodontist, yep, or the radiologist or the radiographer or the ultrasonographer. If they were to go in there and say, oh, well, my sister works at reception, she looks at a few images. Yes, she might have a pretty good idea about how to interpret some of those images. I'm not arguing that she doesn't, but she's not an ultrasonographer, nor a radiologist, nor a dental veterinarian.
I think that's an important point to make too, because I think a lot of people get quite confused about that, and it causes them to make decisions really based on not very much information. So I think that's a really good point to make. So in terms of the profession, I want to know why you did it. Why do you want to spend your life up in horses' mouths?
Yeah,
it's pretty hard work.
Oh, look, it's not a... Yeah, I always say it's a young man's game and I'm not getting any younger, but why wouldn't you do something that's so... To me, it's very interesting. If I was bored, I would have left long ago. That's another comment. It's not an unusual comment for people who don't really understand what it is that we do, to say, well, don't you get bored looking in your mouths all day? If that were the case, they'd have to all be the same, and we'd have to know before we opened them what was going to be going on in there. Throw in, you know, all of the other problems. I mean, you can relate, Amanda, as someone that cares for horses in a capacity and someone who's had horses and rides horses and is around people that rides horses, you can relate to probably what I'm going to say next. Racing is called the sport of kings for a very good reason. You take the amateur rider in any discipline who has 1, 2, maybe 4 horses, especially if they're a family and they've gotten involved in pony clubs, then they've got to go through the whole thing of having all the different aged ponies. Then they've got to be able to provide for all those horses, provide care for them, have the float for them, have the tack for the kids, have the tack for themselves, all of that expense. Then they've got to keep the animals sound. And then when we go back to the competitive and the competitive amateur riders, just focusing on their own, not necessarily having kids, they're trying to get, particularly with dressage, a horse to go through many number of years to get the level of experience that it needs and training to get where they want to go. They've got to keep themselves fit. They've got to keep the horse fit. They've got to pick the right horse. The horse has got to stay sound. And that's what I mean by when you throw in all the other factors of looking at the whole horse. It's an incredibly complex lottery for people.
It absolutely is. And you're dead right. It's not a cheap exercise, but by the same token, people get so attached to their horses, it really takes them down that track. And I think, you know, we often talk about no hoof, no horse, but I've watched you work over the years and it's really no teeth, no horse, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I agree with you. I guess, again, it's being on the other side of the fence. There's, you know, it's trying to sort of, as you say, trying to give people more information to help them be better informed.
Yeah.
So one of the important points there is that, yeah, we do get the cases that come through that are the 1% of horses that are trying to die, and I see a lot of that 1% because of the role that I'm in. However, and partly because of what we talked about before about, you know, people getting attached and the education and those horses like that. But however, I think it's really, really important, and this is poorly understood by a lot of veterinarians in practice, a lot of veterinary students, by a lot of horse owners, is that there's this concept, and let me illustrate it this way, Amanda. If you were to go down the main street of, let's pick Gisborne, it doesn't really matter. If you were to go down the main street of Gisborne or even, you know, one of the main streets of Melbourne and walk down the street and tell me which people as you walk down the street have the dental disease.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the woman in her 20s that's, you know, not in any way, that doesn't appear out of shape or overweight? Is it the man in his 50s that appears very overweight? You know, you can't tell from the outside, other than statistical generalisation, most of the time, who has the dental problem. And horses are exactly the same.
Yeah. They hide things too. Like, they really don't show a lot of pain until it's a long way down the track sometimes.
Yeah, they're a prey animal, and that's another important factor. But the other thing is that I still believe very strongly there's a strong misconception in the horse industry, which I think that principle hopefully explains away as just, you know, something we need to forget about. There's this concept among many owners, many trainers, a lot of vets still, that you can, you know, skinny horse, bad teeth, fat horse, must be doing okay.
Well, I've had plenty of horses through that they look terrible, terrible sick and all that sort of stuff, and their teeth are the best thing about them.
That's right. If you're looking at weight loss in horses, you know, you've probably got, off the top of my head, 10 common differentials that you're looking at. And, you know, dentistry will be in that top 10, but it's not going to be number one for a lot of them. It doesn't mean people should forget about their teeth, because people swing pendulum-wise from one thing to the opposite end. But what I'm trying to explain is they should remember that because, say, 9 out of 10 of the horses they have in the paddock look what they would call fat and healthy, they should remember that unless those horses are getting regular scheduled exams from someone who knows what they're doing, they are definitely, and that's the key difference, they are definitely suffering. It's not an if, it's not a maybe, it's a definite. And so here we have a very obvious welfare issue, but also we've got something that long-term, the effects of it long-term are much more serious.
You're quite right there. I don't know, you probably don't remember, you see 1,000 horses a year, but you came and did the teeth of one of my horses who had been done previously fairly regularly. But you, having a look down there with the camera and everything, you picked up that she had a raised back molar that was sitting above the rest of the teeth and actually preventing her from eating well. And over time, had we not done anything about that, that was going to cause her a lot of grief. And that hadn't been picked up in the last, you know, year or two. So it was really, and she was fat, healthy and well.
And that's the thing. So as dental vets, we see this sort of stuff on a daily basis. That's, you know, if that was an unusual situation, then you know, perhaps we wouldn't spend so much time on education and trying to explain things to people.
Yeah.
It's not an unusual situation. Nor is it an unusual situation to see these things and explain them and then have owners go back to doing what they've always done and not understanding that if you don't get things right and actually fix the problems, you're going to go right back where you've come from. I mean, I'm not too interested in the politics. What I'm interested in is the outcomes.
Yep.
And what I would say to you is this. If you're thinking about dental care for horses, have you got eyes in your fingertips, man?
Not really.
No, you don't. So the next time someone's looking at having dental work done on their horses, there's a whole swag of other things to consider. But just just to keep things really simple for people, if someone's using their fingers as eyes, and only their fingers as eyes,
yeah,
perhaps you should ask some harder questions about the quality of care you're getting.
Yeah, I think that it's quite interesting because if you went to the dentist yourself and he ran his fingers around your mouth and said, think you're good to go, you'd probably feel a little cheated. But we've kind of been trained as horse owners all of that time to see that as the norm and how our horses got looked after because, you know, decades, hundreds of years of that's how horse dentistry was done.
Yeah, again, there's a whole political thing around that, and I'll try and stay away from it, but essentially, you've been cheated.
Yeah, I think so. Like, if you think, you know, if you relate it back to the way that you... But it's not, you know, we don't realise that. We don't think about that. We think it's okay.
The best cons are the most believable ones.
Yeah, yeah, and no one's doing it deliberately. They just think that they've got it right.
Let me illustrate it another way. If you try to look in a horse's mouth, if you do then go from using your fingers to having a look, but you don't have a clean mouth, and by clean I mean absolutely clean, and you don't have a very bright light, what can you see?
Yeah.
What can you see?
Yeah, because there's a lot of stuff packed up in there that they sort of tuck behind things and in between teeth and all that sort of stuff. A lot of gunk comes out of there, doesn't it?
That's all true, but if you look in there without a light, right, what can you see in a horse's mouth?
Not much. It's pretty dark up there.
Yeah, the answer is essentially nothing. So, if you look into a mouth with no light, how long does it take you to work out you can't see anything? And it took you about 15 seconds to work out that you couldn't see anything. Now, if it takes you 15 seconds to work out you can't see anything, how long do you think it takes someone who does it for a living to work out they can't see anything?
Yeah, not very long, probably.
No, but do they stop doing what they're doing?
No, they don't. And I find this extraordinary that people continue to... It's a mindset thing, really, isn't it? It's just you get into that mindset that this is the way it is and never question it.
Exactly.
It's very, very weird. So that takes us into the other piece that people often have a lot of misconception about. And I'm going to ask you to talk about sedation during... you know, a lot of people... concerned about sedating their horses. And the other thing that's concerning me a little bit, which I'd like you to touch on, is that I've come across some horse dentists who are now using sedation, and I was of the understanding that you needed to have permits and licenses to hold those sort of drugs.
Okay, if we're confining this conversation to Australia...
Yes.
It doesn't really matter, but obviously everywhere is slightly different, so it's simpler to talk about. There is only one state, let's get this really clear, there's only one state in Australia where there is even the possibility of a horse dentist applying for and being granted a permit to use sedation for dentistry in horses, and that state is Western Australia, and they're only allowed to use it in Western Australia.
Yeah.
So if you... that's what it was introduced for. It's being abused, and there are only two people, to my knowledge, who have that permit in Western Australia. So most of the people operating in Western Australia are doing so illegally. There is also, and let's not get too into that one because it'll just go on forever, but in Western Australia, that's regulated by the Western Australian Vet Surgical Board. And just to make it just a simple sort of rundown on that. So in each state, there's a veterinary board, which regulates the activities of veterinarians, and we have to pay annual fees and essentially face regulation by them. So if there's a complaint about it, it goes to the board, and the board investigates. Now, the board in Western Australia also regulates the licensing of scheduled medications, so in this case sedatives, for dentistry, for horses, for lay people. Now, when you apply as a layperson for that medication, the board doesn't have any power over you because the board's role in law is to regulate veterinarians. So straight away, you've got a huge problem. The second one is, remember, that dentistry in horses is just like dentistry in cats and dogs. It requires a veterinary degree. So when you ask the board in Western Australia how they assess these non-veterinarians, these lay people, on who should or shouldn't be able to do dental procedures and who should or shouldn't have S4s and what their criteria is, they don't have any criteria. They simply say, oh, we do it on a case-by-case basis, which means they don't have any criteria. If you are one of these people and you are given this licence, the worst they can do is take the licence off you. Whereas if you're a veterinarian, so you're operating in the same board...
They can actually take your registration off you.
You could go to court, you could face fines, you could be sued. So you've got these two parallel people operating under totally different laws. One group who should be providing a good service where they're educated, one group that frankly have very little to no education, certainly about scheduled medication, but that's not part of the licensing. They don't have to attend anything or learn anything. They don't have to keep a register of the drugs that they're using, and they don't have to account for them. Absolutely ludicrous what's going on. Ludicrous.
Not only that, how do they know how much to give a horse? How do they assess a horse as capability and fitness to have that sedation, and how are they calculating it?
No, that's what I'm saying. So none of this is done under veterinary supervision. All of those things are true. They're not supposed to take the drugs outside of Western Australia, but we know, you know, that obviously that's a simple thing for them to do, even though they're breaking the law. The whole thing is a nightmare. The other thing that we haven't touched on, I'd like to move away from this one, but the other thing we haven't touched on with those drugs is that some of those drugs, and I hate to bring this up, some of those drugs are restricted because one of their uses is sexual assault. So
yes,
these are not drugs that we have in the hands of people who are not properly regulated, nor people who are not properly trained in their use. But moving away from that, and back to the real question about sedation itself. So sedation across Australia. So Western Australia is the only state where that exists. So anyone using sedatives for any procedure in horses, right, that applies to clipping as well.
Yep.
Who is not a veterinarian, who is administering to horses, who is not the owner of the horse, is breaking the law.
The owner of the horse, if they were given sedation by the vet who's come out and assessed the horse and understands the dosage and what have you, that's legal, but anything else is illegal.
That is legal in some situations and some jurisdictions. It's not something that I would encourage for the same reasons that we talked about before. How do they know what are they going to do in the event of an accident? How do they know where the carotid artery is, for example, and when they're in it, rather than the jugular vein? There's a whole bunch of things, but yes, that's legal. If you have an insured horse and someone who's not a veterinarian administers sedation to it and there's a problem with that horse, you void your insurance.
Good point to make.
So if you've got your warm blood there and the clipper comes out or the dentist comes out and says, no worries, this one just needs a bit of sedation, I'll give it some. There's an adverse reaction, your horse is injured, or your horse has a problem due to the drugs, you're on your own because you have participated in that activity. You've allowed it to occur.
That's really interesting, and it's been worrying me quite a lot, I must say, because I hear of different people that are, you know, transport drivers and all this stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, how many horses drop, and what recourse does the person have? They haven't, because they've agreed to it.
Yeah, well, usually what happens is that, again, going back to the sort of double standard in the horse industry, most of the time there's an assessment that, look, they weren't a vet, so they're only trying to help me out, you know, he's only a good bloke or she's only trying to do her best, so they take it no further.
Mm.
Again, if the same thing were to happen and it were a veterinarian performing it, the attitude would be different. And so I'm not saying we shouldn't be looking out for what's happening. I'm saying what we need is a level playing field as far as...
Yeah, I think so too.
But back to the sedation itself, because...
Yep.
Okay, again, this stuff comes up all the time. And again, it's horse owners adamantly saying it. I hate to say this because they'll scream at me, but I really don't care after all these years. I've got a pretty... They constantly try to trot themselves out as experts in pharmaceuticals and pharmacology. No, I don't claim to be an expert in pharmacology, but I did actually have lectures in pharmacology. Modern sedatives that we use for the treatment of horses for their dentistry are sedatives and analgesics. So there's a constant thing that gets trotted out about, you know, Why would you sedate horses? One of the things that we're doing is providing these horses preoperatively with pain relief.
Absolutely. That's what analgesic means to the listeners.
Yes. And this is a constant argument that comes up. You know, horse owners scream it at you. It's across all the internet forums. There'll always be some expert who pops up and says, oh, yes, but that's just sedating the horse, which is making it unable to show its, you know, its fear or its pain or fight back or move or, you know, this sort of absolute bullshit, to be quite frank. That's not what sedation does. But more importantly, the sedatives contain analgesia. They contain pain relief. Now, all...
Yep.
This is the problem. Like, dentistry and horses, we're dealing with a level of education on the subject that ranges, to be frank, most horse owners, their understanding of dental care in horses, and this will probably offend them as well, is that of a six-year-old child. That's their level
it's
of...
It's not answer. Something that, that it's not something that gets covered very much anywhere. So
no.
And there's not an, there hasn't been a lot of knowledge out there, to be fair.
Well, there's a lot of information out there, and it's a fair assessment of where we're at in terms of the overall. So there's some people with some excellent knowledge, but if we just say what's the overall level of care in horses across the horse industry, it's that of about a, you know, a child entering school.
Yeah.
Object. So it's not a dig at their intellect, it's not a dig at their intelligence, it's not a dig at their ability to care for their horses. It's just trying to put it in perspective in terms of what they know compared with perhaps what often they think they know.
Yeah.
But that's really important. If you want to move forward, it's very difficult if you've got someone that's going to tell you what they know versus listening, looking at the facts and having a think and then coming back.
Yeah, well, this show is all about the thinking horse person. So hopefully that's the listeners we've got out there, Shannon.
I hope so, but I also hope you've got a few of the other ones, because if we can, you know, if we can get even one or two of them thinking, then that's a win for them and their horses. So back to the sedative thing. The other one that you will hear a lot, and this is another, you know, really sad one that's gone on in the industry for decades, is that you'll see people repeatedly telling people coming into the industry, oh, horses' teeth aren't like ours, horses don't feel pain, they don't have nerves in their teeth, and other such comments like that. There are nerves in all teeth, which teeth you're talking about in a horse's mouth as to how many branches of nerves and blood vessels, but just so it's clear, anyone listening who's not sure, all teeth contain nerves. So when we're doing dental work on horses, are they subject to irritation? Is their pain is the same as when you go in for a scaling? Okay, it'll differ from person to person as to your level of sensitivity and to your level of disease and to the level of involvement that the practitioner, the veterinarian or the human dentist has to go to, but yes. And that's why more and more humans who have the choice, like they have the opportunity to speak up, are opting for, you know, pain-free dental care, as it's called. So in horses, the horses don't have the opportunity to speak up. We know that many of them are in pain. And also, another issue we've got, if you take your 6-kilo cat to the vet, your quiet, white, fluffy pet that you love to bits for a dental, what's the first thing that's going to happen before it has a dental?
It's going to be knocked out.
It's going to be completely asleep. It's going to be knocked out.
Yep.
Completely asleep. So that the veterinarian can competently examine and treat that 6-kilo cat. Now, you want me to come and look at your 550-kilo, grain-fed, 4-year-old, thoroughbred straight off the track and assess its 36 teeth, right? Assuming it hasn't got any other, not a male, hasn't got any other wolf teeth or anything like that, hasn't got any canines. You want me to, you know, its mouth, its oral cavity is basically a foot long, it goes to my elbow, and you want me to assess that accurately, not just tell you I've done it accurately, but actually, you know, show you and be sure, that involves sedation. And a colleague of mine came up with something to try and illustrate this concept to horse owners, and I think it's pretty good. So for anyone that's got small children, taking your small child to the hairdresser when they're having a bad day and they're having a tanty, put them in the chair and then see if that hairdresser will cut their hair while they shake their head. And if they do, see whether you'd pay for the haircut.
That's a very, very good analogy. I love it.
So, you know, you could go on and on and on about sedation, but essentially, hopefully, that sort of covers the basics. The other big issue that isn't talked about as much, and I think is probably, it's at least as important, is nerve blocks.
Yeah.
So, anesthesia. And we use those every day in dental care in horses. And again, that's another big difference between veterinary dental care and perhaps, you know, what else is available. So the nerves in the horse's head, they're the same nerves in all mammals. The only difference is the length of the skull and therefore the length of the nerve. They're pretty easy to access. The blocks are pretty simple to perform. They're not expensive. They're quick. And they block that area of the head. So, you know, if we're taking teeth out or doing surgery that involves taking teeth out where we're going to be cutting into tissue or removing bone, obviously the only way to do that ethically is with nerve blocks.
Yeah, yeah. And it was very effective. I've seen you do that on a number of occasions, and we've done some pretty amazing surgery out in the field with nerve blocks and sedation. So it's pretty pretty effective.
Mm. Yes, I would agree. And I think it's another area that, you know, the more people can understand. I think that one of the other big issues is that people are still, when the cat or the dog goes to the vet for dental care, it's done behind closed doors. Most of drop the cat off and they get it back. Now, they watch RPA, they watch Chris Brown on TV, but they're not used to seeing someone actually there treating their horse standing beside them.
Yeah.
A lot of dental care.
And it can be pretty messy too. Like, it's pretty, if you're taking out a tooth or doing some kind of surgical procedure, it can be pretty daunting for horse owners, can't it?
That's exactly right. We're used to it. We do it all the time. We understand when there's a problem versus what's normal. But, you know, understandably, most people don't. It's not their norm. So that's another challenge in trying to, I suppose, show people those images, show them those videos, try to give them a better understanding of what's normal so that they'll be less stressed. Because, it, you know, that's the big thing, is the horse isn't stressed. We're controlling the horse. But what we want to do is not stress the owners. We want what they want. We want a good outcome for the horse, and we want them to be comfortable. But we're in a position where we have to perform procedures that are quite invasive, and most of the time, due to the logistics of horse ownership in Australia, most horse owners are having that done at their home or their adjustment where they want to be present.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. It's an interesting space, really, and I think it brings in a lot to the emotional connection that we have. And I liken it to, I did a lot of paediatric emergency nursing in my day, and we would often have always the parents would stay, and it's the same thing. If those procedures were happening to adults, they would be behind closed doors. But when they happen to children, inevitably we'd have half the people on the floor, having fainted during the procedure. So it is hard. It's no doubt about it. This is not something people are exposed to normally.
No, and I think probably people don't necessarily, and it's understandable that they don't because it's not their area or their sphere, probably realise how much, and I know this across my colleagues, how much demand there is on any large animal vet during their day. And it's not the purpose of this, so I won't dwell on it, but in terms of all the things you're just saying, you know, the vet's monitoring the animal, the vet's monitoring the pain relief, the vet's dealing with the owner, the vet's dealing with the phone calls, the vet's dealing with the travel, the vet's dealing with the surgical procedure, the vet's keeping an eye on the blood loss, the vet's making sure they've got the stock in the car, you know, they've got all the instruments. My colleagues are exhausted at the end of any given day.
Well, it's a lot to manage, and I think it's incumbent. And I think the stress for horse owners is, am I doing the right thing? And I'm putting my trust in this person, and are they doing the right thing? Because there's so much, and this happens in the human world as well, you know, things do go wrong and people do the wrong thing. And that's the question that's always going on. So learning, you know, having those reassurances, I think it is incumbent on horse owners to know a bit more so that they've got an informed, they're making informed judgments on what's going on instead of what Google says or, you know, what their best mate says.
Yeah, the problem with Dr. Google, I had a good example of that just the other week. I was up somewhere, we were looking at a horse, had an assessment of some of its issues, showed the owner some of the anatomy. She jumped straight on her phone and Googled the anatomy, showed it to me, started to disagree with me. I asked for the phone, I entered the correct information into a Google search, re-showed it to her, and then she was very happy. So
yeah,
Google's a great resource, but one of the problems is people need to realise it's the same issue. If they're looking, we all do it in our normal lives with Google when we're looking for stuff. We think we know what search terms to use, we think we know what we're looking for, and we get something totally different to what it is that we want. And it's the same thing with medical stuff. You can find some great information, but obviously you have to temper that with your level of understanding or knowledge as to how accurate your search is going to be.
And how you interpret that data, it's very true. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the other contentious subject now, because I'm putting you through all the contentious areas today, Shannon. Power tools. Use of power tools. This is the other thing I hear from horse people a lot. You know, oh, power tools are dangerous and they ruin horses' teeth.
Well, they are if you're, you know, using your circular saw to cut timber at home without a safety cut. They are if you're letting your six-year-old cut firewood with the Husqvarna chainsaw. They are if you're letting your husband near them. However, and he's not a tradie, you know, just a weekend warrior. However, to be serious and answer the question, okay, this is a really easy question to answer. The problem is it's like the other topics that we've covered, there's a lot to cover. So beginning at the start, the first thing I would say is this, because a lot of the people presumably who might listen to this are hopefully Victorians and they follow Australian rules football. So it doesn't really matter whether they do or don't. It doesn't matter if they live in Australia. It doesn't matter if they follow NRL. It doesn't matter if they follow rugby union. It doesn't matter if they live in the States and they follow, you know,
gridiron.
RL, yeah, gridiron. It doesn't matter. But the point is this. It doesn't matter if they follow football, soccer, you know. The point is this. In all of those sports, there are a whole bunch of teams. And if you talk to a fan of any one team, particularly certain teams, they'll be very one-eyed and they'll tell you there is only one team, right? Yeah. However, without another team, there wouldn't be a game. So what happens when it comes to the use of powered instruments, and we'll go into this in more detail in a second, is that people want to put things in nice, simple boxes and say, right, power tools are bad. That's what they say. And then they tell everyone else, power tools are bad. No, they're not bad. Take it from someone who's got all the letters after his name and should know what he's talking about and can produce the published research. Power tools are not bad, okay? So if you're going to tell people stuff, tell them power tools are not bad. But here's why. First off, it's not about the tool. As we touched on before, it's about the tool with the tool, okay?
Indeed, so, it is, yes.
So in the same way that when I come out to do surgery, I'm going to use a scalpel blade. And a scalpel blade is very, very small and surgically sharp and sterile when it comes out of the packaging. But I give the same scalpel blade to someone else who's not a veterinarian, or they give it to their child. That's a very dangerous situation, but the scalpel blade hasn't changed. What's changed is whether it's being used correctly. So what we have is this. Dental instruments, so instruments actually specifically designed for doing dentistry, are very safe. We've got two problems. One, there are a number of things on the market that are not dental instruments that you will find in the hands of people being used for dental care because they're easier for them to get a hold of. They're used instruments that are made from or cobbled together from things available from the hardware store. Now, they might then couple that to available dental instruments, but the problem, for a start, is that they're using things in a way they're not designed to be used.
Yeah, so like the drill has if you used a hardware drill and attached dental instruments to it, the revs per minute and the cycles are much stronger in that piece of equipment than a proper dental.
Yes, but when you change the materials that you're using on the burr end, and when you change the motors, there are issues there to do with speed and heat and so on. Not necessarily uncontrollable issues, but it really, there's no need for it because there are specific instruments that are designed, have been tested, and are available to veterinarians for veterinary use, and that's the big difference. The second one is, and this is another common problem, is that there are procedures being done on horses that shouldn't be being performed on horses. Now, that's not the same as power tools bad. That's people, it comes back to people, it's people with a lack of knowledge Often people who've had it pointed out to them many, 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 many times but refuse to change because they believe in their ideology.
Yeah.
And the procedures they're doing are causing great harm. And unfortunately, the really sad part about that is, A, how common it is, B, that the horse owners involved usually have an associated guilt, so they don't necessarily go much further with it once it's pointed out to them. They might have the problem, but they don't do anything to challenge it, to stop it happening to other horses. That's that part. And C, of course, is the poor old horses. Because what we're talking about is usually multiple that die and become infected because of the inappropriate treatments. And by inappropriate treatments, the most common one I'm talking about is, and listen closely to this, the cutting of horses' front teeth. Now, there is no reason why we ever need to cut horses' front teeth. We might have to occasionally, but that is A, occasional, and B, not the same as cutting them. In the same way that if you had a callus on your fingertip, you wouldn't take a pair of rongeurs or scissors or forceps and arbitrarily pick a spot on your finger and cut it off.
No, it would hurt.
So you might be cutting through the knuckle. But you would start at the tip and work your way down from the top, and that's what I'm saying is the difference between cutting and reducing. So reducing is where we start on the surface of the tooth and we remove safely whatever tooth we're able to, and we're cooling and we're reassessing to make sure that we don't damage or expose sensitive tissues, blood vessels and the nerves.
Yeah.
Whereas when you arbitrarily just take a point across the teeth and cut them off, which doesn't need to be done in the first place, is the other key point, you run a very high risk of damaging those tissues, and that's what we see a lot of. Multiple teeth dying and becoming infected quite a long time later.
It's quite a long time later, isn't it, too? It can be months.
It can be years.
Mm.
So, you know, there's often not an, you know, again, owner's perspective, understandably, you know, they probably didn't have the knowledge in the first place. They've been taken for a bit of a ride. Their horse has suffered. And then the symptoms are very subtle as well. We're talking, you know, people think when they think abscess, they think, oh, it's like the cat's abscess, the great big thing that I had to run it to the vet for and had all the flushing and antibiotics. Tooth root abscesses in horses, by and large, are very subtle. And abscesses are things like front teeth incisors, canines. You're talking about a tiny pink dot on the gum where the pus is draining from. So they're not very clever. And as far as the nerves, that part of the tooth is normally dark brown to black. When it dies off, it becomes dark brown to black. So again, to expect someone to pick that up just out there feeding their horse or putting tack on, it is not, you know, you wouldn't expect them to. So that's one of the reasons why we do these detailed exams, and those problems are very, very common. You know, I'd be doing those surgeries 2-3 times a week.
It's quite astonishing. So that covers power tools, and I was just, as you were talking, I was just having this little vision of my own dentist coming out with me for Ryobi and a dental thing, and thinking how I'd be pretty upset about that too. So I think we need to think more about, you know, our own dentists have been using power tools for hundreds of years, like forever. So it's not something that's unusual, really. It's just been unusual in the horse world, but now it's been around for, you know, 15, I don't know, how long?
Well, that's another interesting one. Again, there's a misnomer there, because powered instruments in dentistry and horses have been used since the 20s and 30s.
Right, okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
No, and a lot of stuff's been used since the 30s. There's video footage for teaching of veterinary students from the 30s about equine dentistry. And that involves most of the things that we do today, x-rays, portable crushers, powered instruments, casts, extractions. What they didn't have back then was the more sophisticated pharmaceuticals. They didn't have the sedative we have today. But they had a pretty good understanding of the anatomy, and they were doing all of those things. So, yeah, it's not so much that it hasn't been going on, it's that hasn't been common knowledge and it hasn't been going on as commonly.
That's the other thing too, is that we're getting this information from people who've been doing teeth for horses a long time, who kind of bring that story with them to hang on to their ideology. Ideology is an interesting thing because research, the research on research into implementation is that the average piece of research can be very, you know, that's strong evidence that something, a new practice is more, much more effective than an old practice, takes anything from 10 to 20 years to enter mainstream practice in the human world. So I can imagine that it's probably even longer in the veterinary world across the board, not just horses. So,
oh, absolutely. I think that's a very, you know, I'd agree with those figures. I think that if anyone's, you know, if anyone's gotten to this point in the conversation and they want to find, they want to get in touch with someone worldwide to ask them about dental care and horses, the place to go is equinedentalvets.com.
Yep. There's heaps of really great information there. So I just we'll sort of get along. What I like to leave listeners with is what are the key things that horse owners can do to keep their horses' teeth in good nick? How often should they be getting them treated, done? All those sorts, and what should they look for when things go wrong? Now, if you can just do that in like 2 minutes or so, no, I'm joking. It's a big question.
Yeah, no, that's easy. the big thing that they're going to see is nothing, and they should think about that for a second, right? So the big thing they're going to see as far as signs of dental disease is nothing. If they actually see signs of dental disease, so if they've got sort of nasal discharge, by which I mean coloured nasal discharge, probably from one nostril that doesn't respond after one sort of round of antibiotics. If they've got swellings in the cheek, facial swellings, horses dropping feed, horses washing its mouth out in the water trough, horses yawning, making facial expressions, horses having difficulty in the contact, horses got a head tilt, horses bobbing in the contact, horses lugging, horses, you know, as you go through a transition, like we're switching here from chewing problems obviously into riding,
yeah,
problems.
Riding problems.
And the riding ones are probably the ones they're more likely to notice because
yeah,
the more educated riders are going to pick it, and also because it affects them more directly. You spend more time on the horse's back than you do feeding them, generally speaking, because you toss the feed in and most people have other things to do and they've got to feed the next horse, right? They don't stand there and watch the feed. So if you're seeing any of those things, yeah, you definitely have a problem and you need to call someone. It's as simple as that. No ifs, there's no buts, there's no, oh, maybe I'll wait, or who do I call? You need to call someone, you have a problem. Simple. If you don't see anything, chances are you have a problem because horses' teeth are not like humans. They keep erupting over life. Within 6 months, at most ages, horses will have simple dental problems that need correction. And if you correct them regularly, properly, you get far fewer of the other problems come along. And when they do come along, again, if they're identified early and treated early, again, you get far fewer problems. It's the old story. You know, stitching time saves nine is equally true with dental care. So do the basics, do them well, do them regularly, and stop and think about how often, particularly in performance horses, only because the poor old broodmare tends to get a bit more neglected, not because she should, but they generally do. If we talk about performance horses, how many times a year do you see your farrier or your trimmer? How many times a year?
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
So how many times a year do you think you should be seeing your dental vet?
Well, would you see them 4 weekly though?
Oh, no, that's not what I'm suggesting. What I'm saying
is... Yeah, well, you'd say you've got to see them a week, at least a year, or depending on the horse, really.
Twice a year, really. But what I'm saying is this concept that once or twice a year, somehow someone's trying to pull the wool over your eyes. But hang on a minute. Yeah. See the feet, and you've got that guy or girl there every 4 to 8 weeks, depending on their cycle, and no one bats an eye. And no one bats an eye how much money's going out the door each year on that horse.
Yeah, that's true. It's a funny, it's really comes back to the way we think about it.
Absolutely it does. And so what I'm saying is you can't see the dental problems, so people ignore them.
Yeah, whereas if you saw their feet are obvious because they're sticking out there and showing them to you.
Exactly. And in the same way that if you are doing any kind of performance riding and you start to get that scratchy, subtle lameness, right, it's going to your ability to ride on Sunday. You're going to be down there having the lameness workup, contemplating, you know, nerve blocks and going up from there to see if you can find the problem. And certainly the most important thing for you is going to be fix the problem. Now, go back to what I said earlier And again, you have to choose the right professional, right? Not all dental vets are equal in terms of their understanding of riding and their knowledge of head carriage issues. But if you've got head carriage issues, your first port of call should be to call your dental vet.
Yeah.
Same way.
Absolutely.
If your car isn't going down the road straight, your first port of call is to go in and get the guys to check out your wheel alignment and suspension.
Hmm.
So there's a lot of performance riders out there who are very good at what they do, and they can get a course, they can get a horse around that cross-country course or through that dressage test and still score well. And I'm not suggesting that they, but what I am saying is those horses could do better.
Yeah.
And
are the ones that are healthy and sound and kept, you know, in top athletic condition.
Well, I'm saying those horses could do better than they're doing.
Yeah.
The rider, although they're a very good rider and scoring well, has an impediment to their success. And then the other factor is we've got to put in the variable of you could have the same horse and put a much less experienced rider on it. They're A, probably not going to pick the problems, B, going to cause their own problems, and C, not going to do anywhere near as well anyway. So
yeah,
if it goes back to what
I said,
the whole horse and the whole scenario and the whole environment and why people need to be critical about what they're trying to achieve and what they're looking at.
Oh, well, that's really, you did manage to do that in a couple of minutes. Well done. So really that's coming towards the end of our interview or our chat, which has been fantastic. I've learnt lots and it's been really good messages to get out there, I think, to horse owners. But if I was to ask you to give me one or two key messages, what would they be?
Keep your horses regularly up to date with someone who knows what they're doing. Ask lots of questions, some of which you perhaps know the answer to, and be critical about the answers you get. If you're not happy with the answers, seek a second opinion.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. Thank you so much, Shannon. That's been really a great talk, and I know that can you tell the listeners where they can find you and your information? And we'll put also that on the show notes when they go up. So just give them where can they contact you, Shannon?
Yeah, sure. Again, I'll give that plug for dental vets because that does put them in touch with veterinarians worldwide, not just my
yep.
book. I'm, as you know, quite hard to catch. So it's equinedentalvets.com and
yep.
from there go and select their country and their region. If they want to get in touch with me personally, it's advancedequinedentistry.com.au or advancedequinedentistry.au is the Facebook page.
Fantastic. Thanks so much, Shannon, and I know that you've got a really busy day ahead of you, as always, and globetrotting the world, as you do. So I'll look forward to catching up with you in the future, and thanks very much. Happy horsing.
Well, what did you think of that one? It's funny, really. For some reason, there's a lot of controversy in the horse dental care field, and there really shouldn't be. Three take-home messages I got from this interview were, number one, by the time your horse exhibits sign of dental problems, it's probably already a long way down the track. Number two, check the credentials of the person you're getting to work on your horse and use your common sense. If this was you and your dentist was working on you this way, would you be happy? Would you be happy if you cut corners? Number three, prevention is better and a whole lot cheaper than cure. And I've seen this more than most, I guess. I get to look after quite a lot of people in this boat. And 6 to 12 monthly dental care is optimal. Hopefully you feel better equipped to understand what's going on with your horse's dental care now and know what questions to ask of your practitioner. If you like this show, please leave a comment on iTunes and let me know that you're out there. I really do appreciate it. For more great horse tips, follow me on our Facebook page at the Equine Care Clinic. Until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.